Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. At the center of Trump's three presidential campaigns was an anti-war message. The U.S. would never again fight very expensive and open-ended foreign wars. This all changed when the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran. There was supposed to be forced regime change. Now, there's a forever war. Crosstalking the war on Iran, I'm joined by my guest, Marwa Osman in Beirut. She's an assistant professor at the Lebanese International University and a political commentator. In Berlin, we have Kavirk Almasan. He is founder of Syriana Analysis. And in Tampa, we cross to Jalisa Daru. She's an independent journalist and reporter specializing in the Middle East. All right, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start it off in Beirut. Marwa, this is the sixth day of this unprovoked, unnecessary, and obviously illegal, though that category has probably been retired for the rest of our lifetime, unfortunately, but that's the case. Where are we right now? I'm calling this program asymmetrical attrition. Does that ring a bell with you in what we're seeing right now? Go ahead in Beirut.
Yes, it does, especially as reports are being initiated from Zionist Israeli media saying that the Israeli cabinet announced that it will increase the number of brigades that it's going to send into South Lebanon, which means they're planning on a full invasion of South Lebanon, meaning more occupation, which is an illegal act, not mentioning that the illegal act was already going on for 15 months now after the so-called ceasefire that Israel never abided by, with 10,000 violations, aerial, sea, and land violations by Zionist Israel. So when Hezbollah said, that's enough, I'm not waiting anymore, I know you're preparing for an invasion, and you've killed the most powerful person for the resistance, so I'm not staying silent anymore. So he initiated those missiles that basically did nothing, but did something very important, which makes sure that there are any more civilians in South Lebanon. Hezbollah made sure that if he begins that target, that people will leave the area knowing that Zionist Israel will attack with full force, knowing that it is preparing for an invasion. And that's exactly why the Hezbollah resistance forces initiated those missiles. And it wasn't an initiation. It was a legal retaliation after 15 months of more than 500 Lebanese civilians killed in broad daylight, more shops, more buildings brought down, more occupation. So yes, it is asymmetrical, but at the same time, we've seen that the resistance was able to initiate retaliations from the very outmost towns and villages. My town, for example, Khiem, which is on the border with occupied Palestine and on the border with occupied Golan Heights as well. It was considered a no zone for Hezbollah, but Hezbollah ended up coming from underneath the ground. This is the Israeli media saying, not me, and fighting. And up till now, I can assure you that Zionist Israel was not able to take that town on its own. So I wonder what they're going to do to take the entire part of South Lebanon.
Yeah, well, and this is what's made it into a regional war, which is by design. Kavirk, I don't know, you know, first of all, they started out with the objective was regime change, and then they gave us like six other reasons. I've kind of lost count, and I really don't care, because we knew this was coming. Certainly, the primary objective is to create as much chaos and death as possible. The United States and Israel are very good at doing that. What is 6 days in, Kavirk, where do you see this going? Because we really do have a fog of war right now. There doesn't, you know, I'm watching it like a hawk, but there's very little you can put into focus. What are your thoughts?
Thank you very much, Peter, for having me. I think the front lines of Iran and Lebanon are, at the current moment, cannot be separated. And Hezbollah has traced movements on the borders with Lebanon, knowing that the Israeli occupation forces were preparing for another decapitation campaign against Lebanon, but also for carpet bombing of southern Lebanon. A few months ago, there was a very famous article published in the Jerusalem Post, and they have discussed the Lebanon as being being part of the Greater Israel Project. And they have brought some scripts basically saying that we need to occupy Lebanon. If there is Hezbollah or there isn't a Hezbollah, this is part of the Greater Israel Project. And this extends between the Nile to the Euphrates. Now, a few weeks ago, we had this very famous interview between Tucker Carlson and Mike Huckabee. And Mike Huckabee says he doesn't mind if Israel expands into the neighboring countries. Have it all. It's fine, he said, right? However, in my opinion, in this case, the counter Zionist forces in the region, I think they have pursued a very adequate strategy in this case. First, it was a preemptive strike from the Hezbollah side against the Israeli occupation forces, which means they had the intel within the Israeli forces that this attack was going to happen. The second thing from the Iranian side, they were prepared for this attack. They knew the decapitation is going to happen. Khamenei was in his residency knowing that he will be killed and assassinated. Yeah. And in all cases, they prepared the type of retaliation that is, as you mentioned, it is a war of attrition. They prepared for 30 to 60 day war because this is how they could exhaust the global economy and put burden on many other economies, which they could eventually pressure the United States to stop the war or to come to a concession with the Iranians that could serve also the interests of the Iranians, because the Americans are asking for the Iranians to capitulate, and that is not going to happen. Yeah. So the Iranians are retaliating against the energy, let's say, infrastructure in the region, but also against some of the bubbles in the region. And I would like to mention Dubai. Dubai is a bubble. It is built on a vision. It doesn't stand on solid ground. It stands on a vision of safety, prosperity, and that if you are rich, you can move in, you bring your money, there is no income tax, the crypto bros are all there. But these people do not belong to this land. They came here because it's an opportunity. And they came here because it was called a safe haven for these people. And now, once this place has been destabilized, the vision will crumble. And the Iranians know that UAE invested $1 trillion in the United States. And hence, the Emiratis will again pressure the Americans to stop this war. So the Iranians are playing smart, whether we agree with the strategy or not, but they're trying to serve their own interests. And I think the strategy of the US to decapitate the leadership so that the hierarchy could collapse, that has failed. Because they missed and they confused between Syria and Iran. Syria was unfortunately based on one person. But Iran is a nation state. It is built on state institutions, and
it's
the killing of Khamenei.
It's a civilization. It's a civilization, one of the great civilizations of human history here. And it's not Venezuela either. Jalisa, you know, the Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, I refer to him as Lady Graham on this program, so no one is mistaken here. He said, this is a religious war. Well, it's certainly a war on a religion. Your thoughts, go ahead.
Yeah, definitely. The Trump administration has absolutely adopted these Israeli talking points and narratives, like we said in that interview between Tucker Carlson as well as Mike Huckabee, saying that Israel can have, you know, the entire Middle East and that it pretty much belongs to them. So we've adopted these talking points that predominantly, you know, belong to Israel and do not represent that of the interests of the American people. You even have reports coming out that Donald Trump and Israel has sold them on this, that this is a existential religious war. You know, he has like a cabinet of religion inside, a woman that prays for them. You know, they have these religious meetings to kind of discuss the trajectory of accomplishing basically the doomsday and the returning of Jesus, which is pretty unfathomable if you think about it. In a war to basically, you know, for salvation is just beyond me.
Well, I mean, it's antithetical to Christian theology. I mean, I don't know what religion they're following, but this is not following the scripture. Marwan, let me go back to you in Beirut here. Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, maybe, you know, English is my native language, but, you know, maybe I missed some things here. Maybe you guys can decipher this for me because I don't understand it. Iran declare war on us. We aren't at war right now. Can you decipher that for me?
What? First of all, didn't Pete Hegseth changed the name of the Secretary of State into from the Secretary of Defense into the Secretary of War. He defines himself as a man of war. That's number one. Number two, wasn't there a negotiations on the first round of the 12-day war when they initiated an illegal strike against Iran? Wasn't there negotiations where the American negotiating team was baffled by the results coming out from the Trump administration when they said, we were astonished when we saw how fast Iran was willing to sign a deal with the Trump administration. And then just after Netanyahu visited Trump, everything changed and the Trump administration decided to go to war while we were supposed to have a meeting on Thursday and sign a treaty or a deal with Iran. So they struck Iran, they killed the top leader, they killed a they bombed a school, more than 130 young girls ages 7 to 12 killed, vaporized when they were supposed to be learning how to write their names. They're now, their names are being engraved on graves, and they say they are not at war. I even heard a statement by Starmer saying that that no one is attacking Iran. What are you, like, mad? And the madness is now overflowing. I don't understand. And at the same time, that if you are not at war, what were you doing at the Congress yesterday when we were voting against or with that war? And the difference was, I think, three or four members who voted pro-war with Iran. And what do you call the continuous bombardment campaign against the Islamic Republic of Iran and other places in the region as well? And what do you call the retaliatory attacks by the Islamic Republic of Iran on all the Gulf monarchies in the region and against the Zionist Israelis, which have now been witnessing what destruction means, the same destruction that they have been inflicting upon the people of the region for decades now? They are, we are witnessing that same damage being inflicted against them when they cannot find a place to hide. And if they try to hide, they are not allowed to hide. On the contrary, in Lebanon, I think we are mad somehow in Lebanon, because our Air Force, our civilian Air Force, the Middle East Airlines, is still operating despite the fact that the skies are filled with interceptor missiles and ballistic missiles.
Only the Lebanese.
They are not stopping people from leaving.
Only the Lebanese can do that. Kavod,
Peter, can I jump in just for to?
Please,
say something about Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham, when he says that this is a religious war, we shouldn't really underestimate why he said that, because he wishes this turn into a religious war. And he thinks that when this turns into a religious war, then all the Christian Zionists in the world, and they will try to use religion again to bring all the Christians in Europe and the United States on the side of Zionist Israel. This is number one. But they also wish another type of war in the region, and that is sectarian war among the Sunnis and the Shias. That's why when he uses this rhetoric, he wants for the people in the Gulf countries to turn against the Shias in this case. And that is also one of the biggest Shia powers in the region is Iran. But Iran doesn't see this war as a religious war. They see it as a geopolitical war. They see it as an existential war. So a civil war among the Muslims could happen if both sides agree that they have to eliminate each other, but not if one side, and this side is the Americans, urging the Muslim Sunnis in the region to basically fight against the Shias in this case. In the contrary, anyone with any conscience in the region watching the retaliation from the Iranian side, after watching everything that the Israelis have done to the Palestinians in Gaza, they are cheering for it. You can see the footage. You can see many people are celebrating. I think this is a strategy that is not going to work for the Americans, trying to make it about religion. Meanwhile, everybody knows that this is about taking over Iran, balkanizing it, and destroying the civilization of Iran itself.
We wouldn't be having this discussion if there wasn't this colonial project called Zionist Israel. We wouldn't be talking about any of these things here. All right, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the war against Iran. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the war on Iran. All right, let's go back to Jalisa and Tampa. One of the interesting things, you know, and we're only a few days into this, and when someone says they think something's going to allow an adventure of this crazy level of craziness, when they say it's 4 or 5 weeks, I'm thinking it's going to be 3 to 6 months, because it never happens the way you expect. But, you know, as American air bases in the Gulf monarchies are hit, the United States is making sure that Israel gets air defense, but not their friends in the Gulf here. And so this should be finally a wake-up call, is that the Americans are not there to protect you. And this may be one of the important legacies of whatever happens, however this conflict ends. I really, I'm just at a complete loss how these monarchies never thought this could happen, because it was always possible. Go ahead, Jalisa.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it would kind of be a mistake to assume that the priority wouldn't always be Israel and that these Gulf monarchies were pawns at the end of the day. They did offer infrastructure and financial investments both ways. I think we had Saudi invest billions into the United States economic sector. And so they had a really strong financial relationship. But as far as international security, they're not really providing that. I mean, we even saw, I want to say if it was earlier this year, if not last year, that Israel was targeting, I believe in Qatar, you know, alleged Hamas targets. And this was completely, very surprising on the international scale and the global scale. Nobody really expected that. And, you know, at the end of the day, all Israel got was a slap on the wrist by Donald Trump and kind of ushered to apologize. So you think they would learn. But I don't really think that they are. After this, I mean, I think that many are hopeful, because this is a topic that has been brought up to me as far as not defending the GCC, of course, and these monarchies, that I really hope that the tides will turn and that the Gulf monarchies realize that a large part of the reason that they even are being attacked is obviously, you know, being attacked on a global infrastructure as well as an economic scale, but it's because they harbor the United States, this empirical, you know, colonial, empire. They harbor these bases on their own, you know, soil that is supposed to be for the people of the region, and they should be defending, you know, their brothers and sisters. And instead, they're just defending the United States, and the United States has essentially turned their back on them. And I think we should all kind of take it for what it is, which is a betrayal and the loudest confession that Israel comes before any other asset in the Middle East.
Well, Jalisa, I mean, they're not there to protect the monarchies. They're there to project aggression against Iran. I mean, that's the real purpose of them. They at the end of the day, they're last in line. Marwa, could we see by the end of this conflict the Americans out of the Middle East, at least out of the Gulf countries? I mean, why would these countries invite them back?
That's the least what we could see. If things remain as is and Iran shows that it is ready to adapt to a long war, which the United States of America cannot handle, which the global economy cannot handle, which for sure Zionist Israel cannot handle, neither does the Gulf monarchies, because if their desalination processes and infrastructure becomes a target for the Iranians, it will be impossible to live in those countries. So not only we will see a no zone for the Americans to be in the region of West Asia, but we will also see a complete revolution at the level of the monarchies, the Persian Gulf monarchies in the Arabian Peninsula, as well as other puppet states for the United States of America, one of which is, I'm sorry to say, Kevork, Syria, which has been basically played into the hands of Zionist Israel. Everything will be reshuffled. So this is an existential war for us here in the region. And we are adamant on giving our best to make sure that the future of our kids is safe, that they have a future, and it is a free from Israel future and free from a U.S. Future. So it's going to be a long war. It's going to be a very big war. We have not even seen what it would escalate towards. And at the end of the day, what always remains is the people of the land, the natives of the land. Even if we have nothing else, we still have our land and our dignity.
You know,
Peter, I think, I'm interrupting. I think nobody can emerge, let's say, victorious from this war. Everybody will lose from this war. But the survival of Iran as a nation state is in itself a victory. And it will be a victory in the near future, in the next few weeks. And after that, although Iran is not going to, let's say, decimate all the American forces in the region, but these Gulf monarchies, they have to recalculate. I mean, they have come under attack in the past 10 years via the Yemenis, for example, against Aramco, and the Americans didn't protect them. Qatar came under attack by the Israelis, and the Americans didn't protect them. Now the Emiratis, the Saudis, the Bahrainis, the Kuwaitis, name it, everybody is coming under attack. Meanwhile, most of the batteries and the air defenses of the United States protecting the Israeli occupation forces over the Palestinian territories. So this, let's say, you can see nowadays some Saudi journalists are talking about that they feel betrayed and they feel disappointed by the United States. Oh. This has to trigger conversation among these countries. But let's be real, because these countries, had they had the interests of their own strategic interests at heart, they shouldn't support this war against Iran, because if Israel wins this war and it expands in the region and of what people call in the online community a Pax Judaica empire in the region, they will lose parts of their countries. Saudi Arabia will lose one third of its country to the Greater Israel Project. Lebanon will be part of it. Two thirds of Syria will be part of it. Jordan will be disappeared from the map. So I don't understand what these countries are trying to do by supporting the Americans in this war. They're just shooting themselves in the leg.
Yeah, well, they've been drinking the imperial Kool-Aid for way too long, okay? And now comes the hangover, okay? And Jaleesa, one of the, you know, in looking at the European response, it's just as peculiar and out of step as the Americans. I mean, it's really quite astounding. I really didn't know that Iran was attacking everyone unprovoked. This is coming out of European capitals, with the exception of Madrid. But I mean, what is interesting to me is I was trained as an academic historian, and you know, we've talked about the post-colonialism and post-modernism and all this other mumbo jumbo. You know, they're just back in lockstep. That 500-year run, they're not done yet, okay? This is a war against the global South. This is a war against Iran, first and foremost, against Russia, against China, and everybody else in the global South. This is what this is about. This is the front line.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that messaging has, I mean, it's been distributed widely. Even in the West here in America, you see so many congressmen, you know, Pete Hegseth, Marco Rubio, the president himself, kind of saying that these are, you know, unprecedented strikes, you know, that Iran should, you know, that these kind of came out of nowhere. It just happened in a vacuum. And this is kind of the talking points that they're, you know, spreading. And I think that the American people, as well as worldwide, were waking up. This is not post 9/11 anymore. We have more coverage, you know, to kind of see the truth for what it is. We're sharing more data than ever on what is happening on the ground. And I think many people are seeing through this messaging. They, you know, the United States as well, I think just people in the West and even Europe, right after 9/11, we were galvanized as you know, just galvanized in general to intervene in the Middle East or in that region and bring a war. Right now, you don't really have that. And so, you know, other than, you know, mild statements that we have to protect Israel is kind of all they have to cling to. We don't have anything for this war against Iran that generates popular consensus to justify going into Iran. You don't have that. So you see the United States congressmen, as well as their partners in Europe and everywhere, kind of coming up with these narratives to paint Iran as this ugly creature that we just don't understand why they're retaliating or why they would act this way. And the reality is it's a very unpopular war, but they're not going to tell you that. And why is this? This is because the West, largely including Europe, of course, just the West, largely these elites own the media. And this is something that I think people are also very aware of. They own the media. They can control this narrative. If they want to enforce censoring and blackouts, they are able to do this. But like I said, we have, just like the genocide in Gaza, so we have the most documented, we're able to document this beyond means that we weren't able to, you know, pre and even post 9/11. And so people are waking up to that.
Okay, let's go back to Kvorka in Berlin. No matter how this conflict is resolved. I personally think that there will be negotiations, but the negotiations will be on Iran's terms. It's not going to be, you're going to have to do this, this, and this. Iran is going to say, no, if you want to resolve this, you're going to have to do what we say. They are going to flip the script, because the outcome of this conflict, I think, will be with us for a generation, geopolitically speaking. Go ahead, Kabark.
Definitely. The Iranians showed a lot of flexibility to come into good terms with the Americans, and they have agreed on giving concessions to the Americans in this case. But the Israelis have picked on the fight against Iran, because the goal has always been a regime change and the destruction of Iran as a civilization, as you mentioned. Now, when everything, when the people come to their senses after this round of conflict in the region and understanding the gravity of continuing this type of warfare against Iran, then they will accept at least to the bare minimum level of cooperation with the Iranian side. But the Iranians have to prepare themselves, in my opinion, for another phase of conflict that could come in a few months or in a few years, because in my opinion, the empire is not going to swallow this as a defeat for themselves, and they would prepare themselves again for another round of hostilities against the Iranian side. Therefore, the Iranians have to have, in my opinion, a strategy in the region to embolden themselves, their security, and also some of the state and non-state actors in the region, if they want to recreate frontline deterrence capacity against Israel, because this war was not going to be possible unless the Israelis have had their way in Syria and Lebanon in the past 2 years, something that the Iranians, I'm sure, are aware of, and they're going to build new frontline deterrence capacities. Unfortunately, as Marwa said, Syria is gone. It has become a puppet state. So let's hope one of the hypersonic missiles would also change the equations in Damascus by mistake, and that could definitely bring some positive change to the Syrian scene in this case. That would be a great service done by the Iranians for the Syrian people.
You know, as a final thought here, I was trained as an academic historian, and I see the war against Iran as the Battle of Stalingrad. Okay, up until then, the Wehrmacht was invincible, and everyone thought it was inevitable that the Soviet Union would collapse. But Stalingrad told us they can be defeated. It didn't end the war, but it showed that they can be defeated. And I think this is what this is all about right now. All right, this is all the time we have. You've been also very, very gracious in this very important time. And it's a good, I'm very heartfelt that we have so much solidarity. I want to thank my guests in Beirut, Berlin, and in Tampa. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.